Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a very interesting and jam-packed show for you today. So let's just get started right away. At the back end of the show, I'm going to be playing a clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism, the new communism. He's going to be talking about how do we hasten a revolutionary situation and how do newer and more experienced people take responsibility for that. This will be an excerpt from the question and answer section of his latest talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How Can We Really Make Revolution. Before that, we'll hear the beginning of an interview I did a couple of years ago with author and historian Ilan Pappé. It's from a conversation we had about his book, The Idea of Israel, and it is extremely relevant to what's going on today and to what my first guest will be talking about.
On February 4th of this year, the U.S. Senate passed the Combating BDS Act of 2019 by a vote of 77 to 23. What exactly is this law and what's it aiming to do? Esty Chandler is a host of Middle East in Focus on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. She grew up in Southern California and spent decades working in the film industry. In 2010, she launched the Los Angeles chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP, a national organization promoting solutions based on universal human rights for both Palestinians and Israelis. She now serves on the JVP board of directors. Esty, what is this law and what is it aiming to do?
Well, as you know, every 2 years when Congress starts a new session, each chamber attaches symbolic importance to the first piece of legislation that is to be considered. And the U.S. Senate's first bill, in the midst of the government shutdown, remember, was the Combating BDS Act. It was, you know, not a bill designed to protect American workers or bolster U.S. companies or address various debates over border security or immigration or any other pressing matter. Instead, it was a handful of foreign policy measures, the main one being the Combating BDS Act, which creates a double standard for Israel to protect the anti-BDS legislation, which has been passed in 26 states, from the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The bill has also been a top legislative priority for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, for the past 4 years, I believe. So that's what the newly elected U.S. Senate chose to prioritize, protection of a foreign nation at the expense of the constitutional rights of American citizens. And I think that that's important. I think that is a historic event. So the Combating BDS Act, additionally to protecting these state-passed anti-BDS laws, encourages states to adopt more of those laws, which two federal courts have already blocked on First Amendment grounds. And it also seeks to treat Israeli settlements, all of which are illegal under U.S. law and international law, as if they were part of the state of Israel.
Now, there's also a big part of this bill, though, that when you're talking about it being this BDS Act, it's this law, that it's actually a law, too, that would promote and protect state governments that have already acted to implement the kinds of laws or sanctions against Palestine and Palestinians, as you've been talking about. I mean, this is fairly heavy. 26 states have actually developed laws that would be aimed at cutting off the survival, the ability of this Palestinian people to survive.
Right. Well, so like I said, the bill is an attempt to authorize state and local governments to pass those laws that prohibit the state from contracting with or divesting from entities that boycott Israel. This bill excuses state and local anti-BDS laws from the preemption by federal law. But it's important to note that Congress cannot authorize state and local governments to violate the First Amendment of the Constitution. So they're trying to give cover to these states that have done it, and to tell I believe there's 13 additional states that have similar laws pending. They're trying to say, don't worry if you pass them. The ACLU has already brought two cases to court, and federal judges have blocked both of the laws that have been brought before them.
We're actually talking about the BDS. Why don't we tell people what BDS is to begin with?
Sure. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. The call for BDS came from Palestinian civil society. The Palestinian people don't have real representation. Both the government that is in power in Gaza and the government that's in power in the West Bank have long overstayed their terms to which they were elected, and the people really feel like they have no representation. So thousands of activists and hundreds of community organizations and unions and student groups came together and decided to try something new by trying something old. They looked at the successes of the American Civil Rights Movement and the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and decided that nonviolence really was the best tool they had. And they invited civil society around the world to join them in boycotting Israel until it stops abusing the human rights of Palestinians and abides by international law. The goals of BDS aren't a secret. There's no secret goals behind it. They're stated, they're on the website, they're clear. They seek to give equal rights to Palestinian citizens of Israel. They seek to end the occupation, and they seek to have the international right of return that every person on the planet enjoys applied to Palestinians equally.
You know, and it is, it's always struck me as it's really important that the heart that the BDS movement acts with, because there's a point of, look, the Palestinian people have been dehumanized in a massive way. And the BDS movement actually, they've dedicated their lives and given their lives. A number of them have actually given their lives in relation to standing up and saying, no, the Palestinian people are people. They're human beings. And we've got to stand up against what's happening to them, which to me is really not just refreshing. It's really important in the world today.
Yeah, and I think especially for Americans, like, we really have a role to play in this. The occupation could not continue on without the explicit support of the U.S. government. As taxpayers, we give more of our tax dollars to buy weapons. Actually, we give gift certificates to the Israeli government that they get to spend with American weapons manufacturers. Like, this really is about us. And if we look at even here at home, look at the policing, the militarized policing. A lot of that is the effect of what we at Jewish Voice for Peace call the deadly exchange. These, since 9/11, these exchanges that have been going on, bringing Israeli military and police officials here to help train our law enforcement agencies and sending our law enforcement individuals there. And what we have found is that a lot of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that are spent on these exchanges are actually being put forth by major mainstream American Jewish institutions like the Anti-Defamation League that is supposed to be fighting defamation of, you know, minorities against false accusations. But really, they're doing all this other stuff that people have no idea about.
Yeah, yeah, it's important. Now, you know, one thing, it's actually when we're talking about this law that they passed, it does.
Well, it's,
you know,
not a law yet. The Senate passed it. It would have to pass in the House and be signed. And we're going to work really hard to make sure that it is not passed in the House, that we would believe that the democratically controlled House shouldn't even bring it up for a vote.
Just given what did pass now, which, because I think it's important in terms of, look, I mean, there's rarely been a situation where the U.S., in terms of its official structures from the White House on down, you know, that has taken a stand that would really hit at Israel and act in something that was perceived as it's a major blow against Israel. The U.S. has always stood and continues because it's the attack dog for the U.S. imperialists in that part of the world. And it's important in terms of that. You know,
yeah, and oddly enough, the American presidents who have said no on certain things or said that we're going to hold back payments on something have been Republicans, not Democrats.
Right. Yeah. The thing that got me, too, is that, okay, now this law would actually promote and protect state governments that have already or want to implement, they've already implemented or want to implement laws or sanctions against Palestine. And that's 26 states we're talking about now, sanctions in place against companies and individuals who stood up against the Israeli killing machine. This is pretty heavy when you think about it. This is what this is aimed at.
Including California, that we passed, I believe it was in 2015 or 16, they passed anti-BDS legislation here in California. Now, we fought very hard, and they amended it many times, our legal analysts saying, you know, what was wrong with it and them backing off on many things. But still, the state of California withholds a benefit of the state, meaning that if your company wanted to contract with the state of California, if you saw a contract that they were looking for someone to produce some content and your company had a position saying, you know, we boycott Israel, we don't engage in business with Israel, you would have to sign a pledge saying that you don't do that in order to be eligible for the contract. And that's blatantly unconstitutional.
Yeah. You know, this thing about operating on a couple of levels, because one of those levels has to do with the people who want to be associated with or working with the Palestinian people in some way, having to agree with the anti-Palestinian laws that they confront in relation to their work, which is a pretty heavy deal, because if you're going to agree with that, all the things that are being shoved out there now, what's the impact on all of them going to be?
Right. And it's also on individuals. As I was saying, so far, two federal courts have ruled that these bills are in violation of the First Amendment free speech rights. A U.S. District Court judge in Arizona wrote in her decision issuing a preliminary injunction against the law in a case brought by the ACLU on behalf of an attorney who had contracted with the state for over a decade, providing legal services on behalf of incarcerated people, individuals. And he lost his contract to do that after he refused to sign an oath pledging not to boycott Israel. And the judge wrote, a restriction of one's ability to participate in collective calls to oppose Israel unquestionably burdens the protected expression of companies wishing to engage in such a boycott. There's another case of a teacher, a speech pathologist, who happens to be Palestinian, and literally, if she wanted to keep her job, had to sign this loyalty oath to Israel. I really think that as Americans begin to understand this, there's another guy who was trying to get aid for disaster relief from one of the hurricanes. And in his state, there was an anti-BDS law, and he was being asked to sign this document that says, I do not and will not boycott Israel. Can you imagine that? An American citizen? I just don't think that when American citizens realize that our government, our state government, our federal government, our local governments are asking us to sign a loyalty oath to another country, that is going to sit well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're reading this stuff and you're looking at it and you're looking at the rulings that are happening and all the decisions that are being made. And it's sort of like it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And it's not even right to call it creeping fascism now, because you're actually looking at, ironically, the same people whose history comes from, or is concentrated in a lot of what happened to people during World War II and that whole period. And now they're turning around and doing the same kind of genocidal cleansing against the Palestinian people. And that's, and in terms of them actually sort of arguing for that kind of movement, arguing for the U.S. to stand up and get rid of the Palestinian people, all these things, the Palestinian people have no rights, they aren't even people. I mean, I was looking at a picture in the paper the other day about a young kid who was being carried away in a coffin by all these very, very just, I mean, really just torn apart people who clearly were your friends and, you know, family and whatnot, and they were just destroyed. And this kid had been in a series of demonstrations, and I was thinking about it like, now, we used to hear about all the demonstrations a lot. Now, these demonstrations are almost always covered up. And we don't even understand, or it's kept from a lot of people. And people get fed through the kinds of stuff that the Israeli regime puts out to people and that the U.S. propagates and that the people that are trying to pass this bill overall, all those kinds of things make it appear as though the Palestinians are just troublemakers, and it's just, and you never hear what's actually happening to people. And I think it's outrageous. I mean, I saw the picture of this young guy. I mean, he must have been 17 years old or something, in a coffin. And these people just walking that, pulling it down the street, and just the wailing that was going on. And it's unacceptable. I think anybody who has a shred of humanity in them has to declare that it's unacceptable and do something about it.
Yeah, we're coming up in March. End of March will be the one-year anniversary of the Great March of Return. Every Friday in Gaza, they demonstrate near the border fence. It's not really a border. Israel's never declared its borders, but the fence that separates Gaza from southern Israel. And these are people who are nonviolently protesting for their rights. And there's on the berm a firing squad, a lineup, and people are being killed. They, were targeting journalists. They were targeting medics. There's been, famous stories of people coming from all over the world there to help and being shot. They've been targeting the limbs, you know, of demonstrators, and that this just goes on and on. And it doesn't really, as you were saying, make the mainstream news, that people don't, you know, want people to know what's really going on. And on our side, we have U.S. politicians who would never, ever be upholding the policies here that they are protecting there. It's really mind-blowing that they're not willing to speak out against those things here, where they talk about the abuses of immigrants on our border, but they don't talk about the same things happening there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to point that out. You know, one of the things, too, that I thought is that the Palestine Legal people, their argument, they've said that really need people to understand that there's no way that any group of people or any government can legislate away the First Amendment rights to boycott in this country, which is really, I think it's important for people to understand that there's actually, when they're going after the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement, they're actually saying that you do not have a right to stand up and speak out against this. You do not have a right to protest against this. Shut up and just let us do what we have to do. To me, it's horrendous, but it's also enraging and should inspire people to say, you know, we got to do something. You can't sit there with your head buried in the sand and pretend it doesn't go on, because they're even telling you this right now.
That's right. In 26 states, we have the right to boycott America. We have the right to boycott our own government. But you don't have the right to boycott Israel. Like, what does that say about, you know, our government and our elected representatives that are supposed to be representing us? Mm-hmm. You know, there's this old joke, like, why doesn't Israel become the 51st state? Because then they'd only have two senators.
I feel bad laughing about it, but it's true. It's actually absolutely true.
That was Esty Chandler, radio host and member of Jewish Voice for Peace. And we were talking about the U.S. government's attempts to suppress the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive.
That was Checkpoint by Jasiri X. Now we're going to hear an interview I did a few years back with author and historian Ilan Pappe. The entire interview is available on my website, themichaelslateshow.com.
All right, Ilan Pappe, welcome back to the show, man. Good to talk with you again.
It's a pleasure to be on the show, Michael.
I want to jump right into this because I got so much to ask you about. The book is an amazing book, as I was just saying. The
Thank
Idea
you.
Of Israel, A History and Power of Knowledge. The one thing that really jumped at me is you could have written about anything, but you chose to write specifically about the idea of Israel. Why?
Because I wrote enough, I felt like, about the real history of the place, the motives of the sides involved in the conflict, and so on. And I was really troubled since 2010 by more the questions of how the history and the reality is being commodified, how it is being sold to people. And then it occurred to me that a successful kind of propaganda or PR campaign, even about a conflict, even about issues of justice and morality, starts with an idea. I mean, you need to have something powerful as an idea to sell to people, to manipulate people's minds with. And that idea can either reflect quite clearly the reality or can be a very far cry from the reality. And I think the latter case really was the case of Israel, and the way its history and the reality on the ground have been commodified or sold to people throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me, though, as I was reading it and thinking about it later, one of the things that really struck me was that there's this whole, that this carries with it a lot of very serious consequences, because it's not just talking about, you know, okay, it's commodified and all this kind of stuff, but actually what you dig into there and what's revealed in what you do is something that indicates that there's very serious consequences for millions of people.
I agree. Ideas like historical narratives, ideas can be very benign, can be, people's kind of conceptualizing about reality, having an idea, about life and so on, these are individuals, and not much can happen. Whether they're good or bad ideas doesn't matter. But when ideas have powerful political movements behind them, and those political movements transform into powerful states with military, strong military and lethal weapons in their arsenal and so on, these ideas become a nightmare when they have a story that victimizes other people, or whether the story that the idea carries with it is a story of annihilation, dispossession, or ethnic cleansing. So yes, I think you're right. It's almost like something very simple, which is an idea, and a very terrible reality that that idea can create. Of course, there are ideas that also transform people's life in a better way and in a more peaceful way. But the kind of idea I was interested in is really the idea that has its victims as much as it has its benefactors.
I get a sense in reading it that you felt that there was a real urgency around digging into all this now.
You're absolutely right. There is this unbearable gap, for me at least, between what people know today about Palestine and Israel. And in fact, there is even a gap between what people feel about Israel and Palestine, not just know about Israel and Palestine on the one hand, and the indifference of the political elites around the world, the governments, the economic and military establishment to that reality. I felt that if we are not going to sort of address this gap between presentation, if you want, or representation, and the reality itself, the gap will grow, and it will be very difficult to reconnect people to the reality on the ground. It's almost like mirror image, the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, political elites in the West, the way they depict the situation in Israel and Palestine, and probably also in other places in the world, or other situations in the world, and the reality itself. And had it only been a disagreement between me as an individual and those powerful actors, I wouldn't mind that much. But this is a disagreement between millions and millions of people who care about what goes on here, where I'm talking, when we talk about Israel and Palestine, and the powers that be. I mean, this is a gap between society and government, society and politics. And I'm sure it is not only on the case of Israel and Palestine. I can think about many other issues facing us today as a human society in 2016 where this gap appears. But of course, for me, it was urgent to deal with the place I was born in, and it's very dear to me.
And also, if you look at this in terms of the sense of urgency, one thing that really struck me is that, you know, we're living in a period where over the last few years, what has been going on in relation to the Palestinian people in Gaza in particular, but then also the whole question of the settlements and what's happening in the West Bank and all of this, that this is all seems to be coming to a head. And there's one narrative that's being put out there and it keeps constantly being hit at. And that's the narrative that actually puts the Palestinian people as sort of, look, these are people that are basically pretty much a problem, and they're a problem not just to the Israelis, they're a problem to the world, and that Israel is simply trying to defend itself. You know, you think about this. Think about what happened when Sanders here, one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination, he didn't say a whole lot that was really, you know, something that was like, oh my God, was he really saying that about Palestine? He did not submit his, or he did not go and address AIPAC as one of the, you know, the leading representatives of the Israeli government and the Zionist movement. He didn't go, but he sent his comments. He sent comments to them. And then he gets in a debate with Hillary Clinton and he simply says that, in so many words, that look, the Palestinian people need to be treated as human beings, and we have to pay attention to that. And that caused a storm of upheaval in terms of people attacking him and all this stuff. So you think about this in terms of the urgency around digging into all this has, I think, is definitely connected with something is brewing in relation to the whole question of Palestine and Israel.
I totally agree with you, Michael. I think that I think what we are both sort of motivated by is that this is not a complex case that you can sort of excuse people by, let's say, people who are candidates or presumptive candidates for presidency in the United States, for having a kind of an ambivalent attitude towards it, or people in the street would say, you know, it's a complex story, there are two sides to the story, and so on. This is a clear case of a victimizer and a victim, a clear case of an oppressor and an oppressed. One of the clearest cases, by the way, in the last decades. And in fact, for the common person in the street who is not fed only by mainstream media but uses alternative media or has been here, this is very clear. And when you have this clear kind of reality of oppression, of victimization, of discrimination, and yet the powers that be through the media, through their political speeches, through their official positions, claim that, in fact, it's almost the opposite, namely the Palestinians are the terrorists and the Israelis are the poor victims, it drives you mad. It really drives you mad, first of all, on the level of how do you deal with it? How do you deal with this fabrication? How do you deal with this distortion? It's not a fine-tuning to reality. This is total distortion of the reality. But I want to add another layer to our conversation. I think what really motivates at least young people nowadays in many societies around the world to be galvanized around the idea of boycotting Israel and really taking a more active role on behalf of Palestine, is that they know that most of the people who convey this false narrative of what goes on in Israel and Palestine know that it is false. That really gets them, the hypocrisy. I mean, it would be something else if you would say, wait a minute, these people were educated in a certain way, these people don't have an access to the information that we do, or they have too much on their mind and that's why they don't know. You know, if you could excuse this as an ignorance, but you know it's not ignorance. It's a cynical, hypocritical position by people who know very well that people in Gaza have very little chance of surviving 2020. They know that on a daily basis, Palestinians lose their homes and their life in the West Bank, and that Palestinians inside Israel are being discriminated in a system that is not far from apartheid South Africa. They know it. By the way, we also know it because people like me speak to their representatives, let's say the American government. We speak to the consuls here. We speak to the attachés. We speak to the diplomats on the ground, and they tell us. We send reports that reflect the reality, the very same way as you describe that reality, but they choose to ignore it. And let me add to this something else. This is not has not begun today. In 1948, if you look very carefully, as I did, at the original reports American journalists have sent from Palestine during 1948, describing what can only be defined as an ethnic cleansing, a mass expulsions of Palestinians, we know that the editors chose not to publish these reports. And a similar attitude was taken by the International Red Cross and the United Nations. The international community knew already in 1948 that the Palestinians were victims to what can only be described as a crime against humanity. And they decided, because of reasons we may go into it a bit later, for reasons that had to do with the Holocaust and other historical circumstances, that they do not want to publicly accuse the new Jewish state, as they don't want to accuse Israel today, of a policy that if they admit that this is the Israeli policy and strategy, they would have to treat it as a pariah state.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Ilan Pappe. Ilan is a professor of history at the University of Exeter, and his many books include The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and, most recently, Gaza in Crisis, written with Noam Chomsky. He also writes for, among other publications, The Guardian and the London Review of Books. Yeah, it's extremely important, and we will get into that in a minute. One of the things I wanted to, that was brought up to me, actually, even as you're speaking, is this, a point that you make in the book, where you basically talk about, you know, the challenging the idea of Israel. The very idea of Israel, which you write about, which is why I kept thinking about, it's an interesting take on this to actually go after the idea of Israel. But you, in doing that, you have to challenge the entire narrative of all of the Western imperialist countries, and including, yeah, you know, particularly the U.S. You really have to challenge the whole way that they present what they are doing in the world, not just what Israel is doing in the world, but what they are doing in the world as well. And that's a pretty heavy-duty thing to take on, man, and important.
Yeah, and I think it's not just taking them on or challenging their current policies, but also the way that they deal with their own past. And this is where the two case studies of Israel and the United States is so interesting, as two case studies of settler colonialism. settler colonialism, both in the United States or in North America and in Palestine, was a project of colonization carried out by people who were basically persecuted and expelled from Europe. So these were victims of European culture, religion, and politics who found themselves in someone else's homeland and wanted to turn that homeland to their own, as your listeners probably know what happened in North America in this respect. But the interesting thing is that they claim that this annihilation of the natives, whether they were Native Americans or Native Palestinians, that this annihilation was part of the project of enlightenment, of modernization, of improving humanity. And I think that the same logic, if you want, or not logic, rather the same justification is behind American policy in Iraq in 2003, even American policy today in Syria, and definitely behind Israel's on policy. And this is connected to the history of ideas of Europe, the European history of ideas. And I think that's one of the reasons I chose also idea, because usually when we teach in, and I've taught in several Western universities and also in Israel, when we teach the history of, if you want, the Western history of ideas, it's always positive ideas, right? You know more or less a century in which democratic ideas emerged, moral philosophy emerged, liberalism, socialism, and so on. So ideas are always kind of a human conceptions that produce takes on reality that really improved people's life. This is only true for Europeans. It's not even true for all the Europeans. I would doubt whether it was good for all the workers in Europe, but that is, put that one aside. And the name of these very progressive ideas, horrific crimes, were committed about anyone who was outside of Europe. And this is exactly, again, quite a simple story that is totally wiped out, expunged from the discussion of the relationship between Europe and the rest of the West and the rest of the world, between the West and Islam, the West and the Arab world and Africa and so on. So Palestine, yes, I think you're right. What happened in Palestine and the way we understand what happened in Palestine is not just about the Palestinians and the Zionist movement. It's about the Western colonialism and imperialism in the past, but also in the relationship in the world today at present.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think that's really important, but at the same time, you also have this particular thing in relation to, you know, Palestine and Israel and what's been happening there since 1948 and even before that. This whole question of, it's always presented as Zionism is, it's a movement, it's an expression of truth, it's an expression of the will of a people. It's this untouchable and impossible to really get a handle on phenomenon. And you actually spend a lot of time basically saying, look, this is like everything else. Zionism is an ideological question. It's an ideology. And on that basis, that it's open to criticism and it has to be criticized. And I think that's something that, one, is extremely important in terms of getting this, basically the kind of move that needs to be taken in relation to this internationally, but also in terms of even being able to unleash people's thinking in a bigger sense about what the hell is going on there now.
Absolutely. One of the reasons we were distanced from such a critical discussion, and I agree with you. It's the moment you convince people this is ideology, then you can start discussing its merit, its effect, its practice, not just its theory. But for many years, and for many people probably still today, there was a kind of a shield that protected Zionism from such a discussion. And that shield was equating Zionism with Judaism, by saying this is not ideology, this is a faith, a religion, a monotheistic religion, which is something that people believe in, and if you attack that, you belong to that group of people who attacked Jews just because they were Jews, namely anti-Semitism. So the second equation is not Judaism and Zionism, but anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I can't think about any other ideology in the free world. When you discuss it, people tell you, wait a minute, this ideology is immune from such a discussion, because the moment you criticize it, you are the worst racist that one can find. You know, it's almost like saying this is a taboo, this is sacred, and so on. Now, how can ideology that believed in the right to colonize someone else's land be a sacred ideology? You can agree with it. You can disagree. You can say everybody else was doing it. I'm open to all these discussions. What I don't accept is this immunity, this sense that, and believe me, I know it from my personal experience, I paid a high price for this. You are really treated as someone who is violated the most sacred kind of ideas of humanity if you started criticizing Zionism within Israeli universities. I lost my job because of that. And I can't think of a similar case. So I thought that there must be something, it must be a very successful project that you could have sold or commodified an ideology as something which should be untouchable, should be a taboo. I think it's changing, by the way. I'm optimistic. I don't think we'll stay there forever. But until now, to this very moment, many people would still regard it in such a bizarre way.
Well, you know, one of the things that struck me, too, is, and this is sort of a hallmark of your work, everything that I've read by you and when we've talked before in the past, there's a point here that I was thinking about in relation to you in terms of methodologically, and in particular, in terms of epistemology. You know, I think that you really take an approach of having to be, you put meaning and weight behind the term social scientist, and that you actually take a scientific approach, but also epistemologically, you're not afraid to look at what's true. And that, I think, is something that's extremely important. And how you saw that in relation to, in particular, I mean, look, 1948, we all know the movies, the stories, the whole thing that's everywhere, and particularly in this country as well as for sure in Palestine, Israel, other places, it's beaten into your head, the stories of the brave Jewish people who were recovering from this just inhuman and horrible thing that happened to them by the Nazis and da-da-da-da, and all this stuff. But epistemologically, people are encouraged more to close their eyes and listen to what the narrative is, listen to what the story is, listen to that, and not really insisting on, and there's not enough people, I think, insisting on the epistemology you have to employ has to be one that looks for truth, no matter what it is, because you can't know anything without having the truth.
I totally agree, and I think what really got me sort of going from very early on is that how visible this truth is. You know, it was not really hidden in classified archives. It was not kept in a vault in Port Knox. It was there for everyone to see if they just wanted to open their eyes. You cannot wipe out 500 Palestinian villages in 1948 and kind of wipe them out of memory, or wipe them out of people's cognition or awareness. There are even physical remnants for such an act. You cannot destroy the whole urban space of Palestine that was there for hundreds of years and claim that it never existed. The only people who could be so blind to these visible remnants are people who have put these dark ideological glasses on their eyes and then they can't see it. But I was less interested in those people who lived here and refused to see what was so obvious to me. And I think that part of what motivated me writing that book was I was interested, but why everybody else is wearing these glasses, so using the same metaphor, wearing these dark glasses. How come they too are unable to call a spade when it's so obvious and so clear? And I really thought that, as you know, the book claims that there are two mechanisms for human society or human mind today that complement each other and can create a powerful conviction in a lie, in a society that pretends to be open. Because, of course, in dictatorial societies, you just have to use intimidation and fear, and people would believe whatever you want them to believe. But I was talking about a society that allegedly is open. So you don't use intimidation. You don't force people to see something that they don't see. This is something much more subtle. And I claim in the book that the two means that complement each other is, on the one hand, allegedly scientific research, namely you bring academic scholarly proof to the light, you put a lot of footnotes, you recruit your best scholars, and they cheat without either knowingly or unknowingly, it doesn't matter, but they really create a false scholarly production of knowledge. But that's not enough. You need the movies. You need the television. Nowadays, probably you need the internet. Doesn't matter. But you need also something fictional to complement the non-fictional proof. And both the film industry and the academia, in this case, were powerful agents of selling a very simple truth as a very complicated lie. The question is, why does it still go on? I mean, with everything we know and all the things we, some of us have already unearthed and disclosed, but for so many people, especially where you're coming from, it still is the biggest fabrication on earth.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Israeli author and historian Ilan Pappe talking about the idea of Israel. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Maricatu, New York, with the Douglas Street Shuffle. Now, last week, I read a call for a nationwide tour, the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. I'm going to be bringing news of the tour in the coming weeks, but today, I'm going to play a clip from Bob Avakian, where he talks about how do we hasten a revolutionary situation, and how do newer and more experienced people take responsibility for that. Bob Avakian's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism, the New Communism. This is an excerpt from the question and answer section of his latest talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. It's available at revcom.us.
I was raising the question of, you know, the roles of people stepping into the revolution, new people stepping into the revolution, along with people who are coming into the kind of like the end of what we call the Ohio process, you know, more experienced people, you know, more people who have a rich understanding, but still the for both of these roles of people, whether they're new or been around for some years, there's a thing of, you know, them understanding more and taking on more responsibility. And so my question was, how do we actually, you know, hasten toward the development of the necessary conditions for a revolutionary situation? How do we really step on the social accelerator and really make revolution?
Okay, well, if you remember, I'll try to be as concise about this as I can. If you remember during the course of the second part of my talk, I said it would be helpful to talk about what is the similarities and what are the differences with the situation, say, in a third world country where they've been able to wage a revolutionary war from the beginning of the process. Well, look, if you were in that kind of situation where you were waging a war, you would be clearer to you. There'd be lots of difficulties, lots of sacrifices, obviously, but it'd be clearer to you, okay, where are we in relation to where we need to go? You know, we need to eventually defeat their whole thing, you know, and we have to get to the point where we're able to do that. Here's where we are now. So, okay, how do we, you know, the question would be, you know, maybe clearer. How do we get from here to there? And you would start grappling and wrestling with, okay, what are the next steps, the next fights we have to wage in order to get closer to where we, you know, tip things over and we are, you have the upper hand and we're going to finish them off, just to put it, in clear terms, right? Well, without falling into, you know, thinking that you can do exactly the same thing here, that you can wage a war here from the beginning. But applying the same kind of thinking to a different strategic approach, at every point we should be looking at, okay, where are we in relation to where we need to get to? Everything we're doing, like I stressed many times, is aimed at getting to where we can go for the whole thing, where we can actually have a real chance to take them on and defeat them. Not in an easy, you know, it's not that it's going to be easy and fall into our lap, but where there's a real chance that you could have the, okay, where are we now? What are we confronting, right? How do we go about taking the next steps that get us closer to that? That's what it means to hasten. It means looking at the terrain out there. How do we affect this terrain? How do we wield the organized forces we have in the most effective way as an organized force? And through that process, grow, not just by ones or twos, but by leaps and bounds, incorporating more people into the organized ranks. That was my point about accumulate an impact, that you wield your forces. If you have X number of people and they all kind of act in a dispersed way, it has a certain effect, but not that great an effect. If you have a certain number of people and they act as an organized force, particularly in relation to what they can identify as sort of key ways in which things are sharply posing themselves. One big example of that is the whole Trump-Pence regime thing. But there are other examples too. On small scale, a police murder happens. How do you wield your forces in an organized way that actually attracts people to you? And then how do you work with them to be able to have more organized forces so that you can have a bigger effect, not just in one neighborhood or community or even one city, but in a way that impacts the larger society and ultimately even the world? That's why I'm saying, this point I brought up about the BBC doing a special on the youth killing each other in Chicago. Imagine if we turn that around. Imagine if in this situation a revolutionary force is emerging, which becomes a pole of attraction, a magnetic force that's drawing you to that. Well, then the way in which the powers that be have tried to use Chicago in a negative way, and the youth in Chicago in particular in a negative way to say, see how we have to be a lot more repressive, then that'll start turning around into a positive thing. And right now you have a lot of people. I talked about how in my youth, which once did exist, I talked about how in my youth I got attracted to, things like the Black Panther Party and stuff, because I could see two things. They were very serious, and what they were doing was righteous. That's what I understood at the beginning. I hated the oppression of black people from a lot of experience I'd had up to that point. And I thought, these people are serious, and they're very bold, and they're very righteous. And that I wasn't unique in that. That had that effect on a lot of middle-class youth at that time. Now you've got the scene where you got all this, gangster rap and everything, and you got fraternity boys riding around playing it. But that's just another, if you want to be blunt, that's just another expression of racism. Maybe not for all of them, but for a lot of them, it's just like, this is like what they used to call, vocal group music, doo-wop music way back in the day. This is like, rhythm and blues music back in the day. This is jungle music. They're not inspired, by the idea that people are setting out to change the world. They're just kind of like posing. That's very different, than what we went through when I was a youth. We were inspired. And you get a, because people were serious, they were bold, and what they were doing was right, and nobody could deny it except an asshole. People could see that it was righteous. And so if you start having that emerge among people, who are catching the worst hell under the system, the same thing is going to happen. It's going to attract the attention in a good way rather than a bad way of a lot of people in society. Yes, the people who want to put it down and snuff it out, but also a lot of other people who go along with the way things are and even talk about how this is the best of all, blah, 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 bullshit, but who really know that there's something wrong here, but have just sort of had an overlay of cynicism over that, because they don't think you can do anything about it. And all of a sudden you see people who are serious, coming from a serious place, who are breaking through all kinds of shit they have to break through to be out there with fighting for something that's real. And that's going to change things too, not automatically, but it's going to change things. It's going to send an electric shock in a positive way throughout the society. And that is going to create more favorable conditions for for things to grow and make leaps and for more people to advance more quickly. When things are happening slowly, it takes people a long time to go through changes. When things are happening in a very concentrated way, in a very, quickly, things are changing day after day, week after week, and years get concentrated in a month, people also change in a much more accelerated way. So there's no magic thing about it, but, there is a way in which by having our sense of where we're at in the process and where we need to get to, and what are some of the key things that are sharpening up, that if we go after them, we're going to send that electric shock through society. We're going to galvanize a lot of attention on what we're doing. And then we have to work with people in a good way to enable them to be part of this and to develop. I once said to somebody that we have a great advantage and a great disadvantage in having a very developed revolutionary leadership. It's more an advantage than a disadvantage. The big advantage should be obvious. When you have a lot of, developed leadership, a lot of work has been done that people can take up and wield. They don't have to start from scratch and do all that, fight all the way through to do all that work themselves. That's a big advantage. The disadvantage, even though it's not the main thing, it's real, is, for example, when the generation I was part of, when we came forward, we had to fight through to figure out a lot of these things ourselves. We were 21, 22, 18, 19, trying to, conquer the whole world. There were other people we were inspired by and learned from, but we had to figure out a lot of this stuff ourselves. Well, we have to find the way to get the right combination or the right synthesis where people have a lot of this rich stuff that's been done that they can take up. But also the process is created and the means are created where they can figure some of this stuff out themselves in terms of how to actually make it go. Not start from zero, but be part of the process of actually figuring this out. Because that's an invaluable, it's an invaluable experience. There's nothing like that of actually grappling with how are we going to make this happen together with other people and actually learning as you do. And the more that you do that, the more you want to be part of doing it. So we have to find, it's very difficult, but we have to find the right synthesis between not hiding or keeping from people what we do know, but also being honest about what we don't know and what we need them for. We need a lot of people to help us solve these problems. That's why I threw open the question I did. We don't know the answer to everything. Far from it. We know some very fundamental things, and we're working on them all the time. But there's a lot we don't know. Right down on especially down on the level of how things happen with people and how they actually see them and feel about them. And we need those people to be part of this process. It's not just we need them as foot soldiers. We need them to help us figure out, to be part of the process of solving these problems of this revolution. We really need them to be part of that. And they can do it. They can be part of it. This is not something that only a few people can do. Yes, if you've been at it for longer, you've learned a lot of things, but also some things you learn aren't so good. So, you got to keep on learning anew, and we need those people, right? The people, the basic people, all kinds of people to be using their minds, not just like I said, to be using their bodies to be foot soldiers, to be using their minds to come together and figure out how do we break through and make this real? How do we make that next leap and the leap after that? And how do we bring forward not just two or three people, but 20 or 50 and then 100 and 500 people to be part of this? When the Black Panther Party got going, at first, when I started hanging around with them, there was about 8 people in the Black Panther Party. And they were very serious and very dedicated. And then a few things happened that, they had the thing in the Sacramento, in the state government of California in Sacramento, where they took their guns and marched into the state capitol, which got a certain amount of attention. And then there was a whole thing where Huey Newton got into, you know, was accused of killing a cop and all this kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, I'm not saying people should go out and get accused of killing a cop, just to be clear. I'm just saying all of a sudden there was a lot of attention focused on them. And I remember they're telling me, all of a sudden people were coming to them and saying, we want to set up a chapter in this city. We want to set up a chapter in that city. We want to, you know, and hundreds of people were coming all of a sudden. And, you know, they had a real problem. How do they give leadership to these people? That's a real problem, but that's a problem we should love to have, okay? So, you know, this is the kind of dynamic you have to get going, and you need people. It's not, like I said, we just need them to do work. Yes, we all need to do work for the revolution, but we need people to help us figure out the problems of the revolution, to solve these problems, to make these leaps, to get where we need to go. And that doesn't mean that every idea that people are going to bring to us is going to be good. Or correct. Some of them are going to be crazy. Some of them are going to be way off base. Some of them are going to be bad. Some of them are going to be wrong. But some of them are going to have real insights and really valuable, you know, wisdom for us to take up and act on. And that's what we need, that whole process where that's what's happening. So maybe that is, since we're running out of time, a good place to end. But I just want to say, I want to thank everybody for coming. But I also want to say, you know, this really is serious, what we're talking about. It's serious, but there's also a joyful aspect to it because, like I said, you're thinking about the way the world could be and what we could bring into being, even with all the sacrifice. And, you know, nobody should be involved who isn't convinced that this is right and this is what needs to happen and this is what they should, you know, be dedicating themselves to. But everybody who does, and if you're not convinced of that, talk to us and struggle with us. Let's fight that through. But the more that you come to see that this is what has to happen, the more I want to call on people to get actively involved. And with the twists and turns, not to get discouraged. If we have problems, let's solve them together and bring forward more people in, you know, one wave after another to help us solve these problems. Because these are the problems that need to be solved in order for this system to be brought down and a really better world brought into being. So that's kind of what I would like to leave people with, along with thanking you all for coming.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He was talking about how do we hasten a revolutionary situation. This is an excerpt from the Q&A following his latest talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, which is available on revcom.us. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. Thanks to Esty Chandler and Ilan Pape, and thanks to Bob Avakian. And I want to thank all the people who participated in the show today. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.